Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. If anyone down the back can't hear, let us know, but I think the microphones are working. Thanks for coming along tonight. We had relatively late notice, and we did our best to get another facility, but being a Thursday night, everything was booked up, so it's nice to see you here, and you're all so friendly with one another that you're all sitting so close, which is the way we are at the Sydney Institute. At any rate, the talks will be podcast and be up on our pod, and they'll be published in the Sydney papers online. But it's great to have Daniel Pipes back at the Sydney Institute. As I recall, Daniel's been here twice before, and he makes a very welcome return, once in this building and once at the State Library, which was the last time. And Ida Lichter here for the first time. The general topic is changes in radical Islam. And I'll introduce our two speakers. We'll start off with Ida Lichter. We'll go to Daniel Pipes. They'll take about 15 minutes each, and then we'll go to questions and discussion, and of course finish no later than 7 o'clock. So Ida Lichter is a psychiatrist. She practiced in London for a long time and returned to Sydney in more recent years. And she's author of the book Muslim Women Reformers, and Janet Grundy has got some copies of that outside. Janet's also got some copies of some of Daniel Pipes's books published a couple of years ago. But Daniel Pipes was well known to many of you from his media appearances in Australia and his publications, but I'll introduce him briefly. He's the director of the Middle East Forum, and the Middle East Forum, of course, publishes the Middle East Quarterly. Daniel Pipes is also a well-known analyst, commentator, and author. So we'll lead off with Ida Lichter. We'll come to Daniel Pipes, and then we'll come to questions and discussion. Ida, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Gerard, for your kind introduction. And my special thanks to Anne and Gerard Henderson for giving me the opportunity to address the Sydney Institute, which provides such an important current affairs forum for ideas and debate. Tonight I'm going to speak about a group of women in the Muslim world who are passionate and fearless reformers. What success have they had, and how can they go forward? But first, you may want to know why an Australian psychiatrist came to write a book about this subject. Until recently, I lived in London. I witnessed increasing Islamisation and got to know Muslim women colleagues.
Just come a bit closer.
Try this. Is that better? I also became aware of a growing number of Muslim women reformers who are virtually unknown, and I was intrigued to discover that some of them were medical doctors like me. For example, Masuda Jalal from Afghanistan qualified as a psychiatrist and paediatrician, but eventually she stood as a candidate for president and later became Minister for Women's Affairs. These female activists are determined, intellectual, and humorous. Nothing like the stereotype of the submissive Muslim woman. They are leading the Muslim reform movement because they have the most to gain and also the most to lose if radical Islam, a heretical interpretation of the religion, strengthens. Some have risked their lives for reform and died as targets of jihad. Some, like Saudi Arabian Wajiha al-Huwaida, can't understand why a world that was enraged by prisoners in Guantanamo is not enraged by the plight of Muslim women. And she castigates human rights activists with cries of, why? 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 These reformers represent many views and many countries. the most active being in Iran, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia. The secular reformers among them would like to see separation of religion and state, and they reject Sharia in favour of civil law. A few, like Ayan Hirsi Ali and Wafa Sultan, reject Islam outright because they believe it is not capable of reformation. They have received death threats in response to their opinions. In the religious group, which is the majority, most insist that women's rights can be achieved within Islam through ijtihad, meaning critical reinterpretation of the holy texts. In their belief, it is culture, the culture of male-dominated tribalism and patriarchy, that distorted authentic Islam and produced Sharia laws which favour men. So what reforms are these women trying to achieve? They want to abolish stoning to death for adultery, also forced and child marriage, polygamy and temporary marriages. They want equal rights to divorce, custody, inheritance and court testimony, and especially right to education without fear of acid attacks and assassination. They want domestic violence and honour killings criminalised. And in Saudi Arabia, they want the right to vote and drive a car. They want to do away with male guardians who are legally bound to give their permission for a myriad of activities. They want freedom to choose their husbands and their clothing. You might think the niqab, which covers a woman's face except for two slits for the eyes, was extreme. But some religious authorities are not satisfied. An influential Saudi cleric has ordered women to cover one eye so as not to be over-seductive. Above all, reformers want to see changes in cultural attitudes that infantilise them as chattels and baby machines. And they want to expose the hypocrisy of men who defend themselves against charges of misogyny by saying they really honour and respect women when their real agenda is a male-dominated society. They also make the point they're fighting for human rights that include men too. The rights of freedom of speech, assembly and association, and the freedom to change religion. How are they going about reform, and what gains have they made? In the past, major reforms took place in Turkey and also in North Africa. In Tunisia, the government's use of ijtihad facilitated successive gender reforms. Currently, Muslim women are beginning to rise worldwide, aided by education and modern communication. I can't do justice to all the women in my book in a short time, so I will only mention a few. Wasma Frog works in gender research and runs literacy programs in Afghanistan, where only 13% of women are literate. While preparing for a program in the remote northeast, she heard that a local mullah was preaching a fatwa inciting the community to kill her. Summoning up the courage, Wasma walked into the mosque, wearing a billowing black chador, and asked the mullah for 5 minutes of his time. Then she recited verses from the Quran that praised the benefits of education and denounced illiteracy. To everyone's surprise, the mullah backed down and said, "God bless you, my daughter." Wasma believes that more Muslim women like herself must become knowledgeable in Arabic and Islam in order to lobby religious, local, and government leaders to support reform. Her gender research in a southeastern province where early and forced marriage is common practice showed that 90% of families sold their daughters for about $300 and that some of these girls were as young as 3 years old. Afghanistan has seen significant progress since the overthrow of the Taliban, and the new constitution provides seats for women in parliament. They have achieved senior positions in the police force, and in the Bamiyan province, Habiba Sarabi is the very first female governor. In Saudi Arabia, Wajiha al-Huwaida and Fuzia Al-Ayuni led a campaign to give women the right to drive, culminating in a petition to King Abdullah in 2007. The governing Shura Council eventually recommended they be allowed this right. They don't have it yet. Significant recent changes include the appointment of the first woman minister, removal of the hardliner chief of the Mutaween, the religious police, and a ruling that Saudi women could stay in a hotel alone, provided the police are informed. These moves, which are part of King Abdullah's reform program, have undoubtedly been influenced by women like Al-Huwaida. Earlier this year, she launched a campaign against the Saudi guardian law with the slogan, "Treat us like adult citizens or we leave the country." In Iran, women activists have taken to the streets over the last few years and were the vanguard for the reform rallies we have seen since the June election. Their aim is to force changes to discriminatory laws like polygamy and child marriage. With the same aim, they have canvassed people on the street, door to door, and by email as part of their 1 million signatures campaign. For these activities, they have been beaten by the police, arrested and jailed. Some were young students, others were mothers and also grandmothers. Under President Ahmadinejad, restrictive policies worsened, but in September 2008, reformers triumphed when the Iranian parliament denied the passage of a bill that would have facilitated polygamy by allowing men to take a second wife without consent of the first. They also managed to raise the minimum age of marriage for girls from 9 to 13 and lengthen custody of children in the case of divorced mothers. According to Mohammad Javad Larijani, Secretary of Human Rights in the Iranian judiciary, stoning to death for adultery is lawful and nothing to be ashamed of. But lawyer activist Shadi Sadr is committed to its abolition. She led the campaign to stop stoning forever, which publishes news on the internet within hours. When two people were stoned to death in Mashhad in 2006, the reaction by the international community forced the Iranian government to stop these public executions for 2 years. Many reformers and their organizations are working on reinterpretation of Quranic scripture, rejecting the traditional patriarchal perspective. Scholars like Amina Wadud in the United States and the Rahima non-governmental organization in Indonesia have embarked on such projects. A small but growing number of Muslim men are also wholeheartedly committed to furthering women's rights. Reformers who are immigrants from countries where they have known radical Islam at first hand warn us about its insidious dangers. For example, Homa Arjumand, who fled Iran for Canada, noticed that a new organisation, the Islamic Institute of Civil Justice, was attempting to influence Canadian Muslims to use Sharia instead of Canadian courts for settling disputes. Because she feared this could lead to a parallel legal system, Arjumand established the International Campaign Against Sharia Court in Canada and lobbied the then Premier of Ontario, Dalton McGuinty. And in the end, he banned all religious arbitrations and initiated new legislation mandating the sole use of Canadian law. I want to briefly mention the role of the internet. There are now many reform websites that disseminate information in original languages and translations. In Iran, over 100,000 bloggers represent diverse interests. The Iranian government has cracked down on cyber journalists with arrests, beatings, and solitary confinement, and also filtered and blocked their websites. In July 2008, the regime passed a new law to allow the death penalty for so-called online crimes. In the 1 million signatures campaign, many of the forms to be signed online were forwarded, and thereby the signatures were multiplied. In 2008, one of Al-Huwaida's campaigns entitled No to Oppression of Women broadcast YouTube video interviews with Saudi women who testified anonymously to their plight. A similar campaign this year focused on banning child marriage. And in moving interviews of girls on YouTube, many cried they were too small to get married. One said, "We are still children. How can we raise children? I have aspirations. I would like to become a scientist." There are obstacles to overcome. Firstly, laws that are implemented nationally may not influence tribal courts, which dispense customary law and enjoy rural support, for example, in areas of Afghanistan or Pakistan. Secondly, reformers' voices are being stifled because some Middle Eastern countries have shut down many websites and blogs, and also because our own Western media is more sensationalist than serious. There is also potential pressure from UN resolutions against defaming religions, as these could be used to silence reformers. In some Muslim countries like Bahrain, Kuwait, and Jordan, the rulers are in favour of reforms, but Islamist forces from within hinder women's rights. For example, when Kuwaiti reformer Rola Dashti, together with 30 other women, decided to run for parliament in 2007, she had the support of the emir, but Islamists branded the women anti-religious, blasphemous, anti-patriotic, anti-family agents of the West. In addition, elections were held a year early so that the women had insufficient time to prepare. Dashti was one of four women who won the first female seats, however, in the Kuwaiti parliament in May 2009. Many reformers are driven to avoid alliances with Western organisations because they fear being branded traitors or Western agents. There are many who would, however, welcome Western support, but they have been disappointed by the silence of the feminist movement, caught in the dilemma of multiculturalism. You may well ask if culture can be changed. Veteran reformer Shirin Ebadi, Iranian lawyer and Nobel Peace Laureate, believes that changes in culture follow changes in the law. She gives the example of polygamy. Before the Iranian Revolution, polygamy was limited by law and became culturally unacceptable. When it was legal again, polygamy became more socially acceptable. Once women are given a voice and an opportunity to make a social difference, they can bring positive change and progressive ideas to their societies, as in Northern Ireland and Argentina. My research shows that Muslim women reformers are the flashpoints for their regions. As more people accept the need to alter the restrictive rules of Islamic culture in general, and Sharia law in particular, one would hope that the benefits to these nations would be considerable. Islam has hidden away a major social, political, and economic resource. It's women. As stated in the Arab Human Development Report 2005, an Arab Renaissance cannot be accomplished without the rise of women. Directly and indirectly, it concerns the well-being of the entire Arab world. For people of goodwill, empowerment of Muslim women could be an issue of consensus rather than controversy, and a bulwark against radical Islam. But the reformers can't do it alone. As Algerian feminist Khalida Messaoudi said, "In order to secure women's rights, we need a democratic international of women. Otherwise, we have absolutely no chance of conquering this beast."
Many thanks, Tyler. We come to Daniel. Just measure you up. Again, if you can't hear down the back, just let us know. Okay. You want water? Or you're okay.
I'm okay. Thank you. So you do lots of different, lots of different functions at this organization?
Yes.
As any experienced speaker knows, it's not the size of the crowd, it's the density of the crowd that matters. I'm delighted to see a dense crowd this evening. I'm a great admirer of the Sydney Institute. As Gerard mentioned, this is my third time speaking. I also attended your annual dinner for the Prime Minister a year and a half ago. And I've been a faithful reader of your publications for at least a decade now. It's good to be back. It's good to see familiar faces, Alan Gold and others. I'm also a great admirer of Ida Lichter's book. In fact, if you look at it, I'm the first person on the back cover, coincidentally, where I call it a compelling piece of research. Ida mentioned Wafa Sultan in passing. In 3 weeks, on December 1st, I'll be debating Wafa at my initiative. I thought it would be interesting to have a discussion of whether the problem is Islam or radical Islam. And she and I will be discussing this issue, and it will be videotaped for the internet in New York on December 1st. It's never been done before, to the best of my knowledge. No one's actually had a debate on the question of what is the enemy, what is the problem. My topic, and I'll be very brief since we've already used up a good part of our half hour, is the evolution of radical Islam in recent years. The primary figures in the first phase of this phenomenon in the 1980s and 90s, and indeed until the first years of this millennium, were figures like Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran and Osama bin Laden from Saudi Arabia. And while they're very different, they share a brutality in common, a willingness to use force, terrorism, criminality, totalitarian means to impose the Sharia, Islamic law. I think it's safe to say that this project is not going to succeed. The Iranian Republic, although it's been around for 30 years now, is doomed. It does not have the following of its people. The Iranians, by large measure, reject the system that they live in. Bin Laden's vision is unattainable, clearly. And while these kind of Islamists who use violence and who are ready to impose their will through brutal means are dangerous, very dangerous, I don't think they can achieve their goals. They can kill people. The 200 people in Bali and the 3,000 in New York and Washington are actually very small numbers compared to what it could be. Bin Laden's been known to look for atomic weaponry. It could be in the hundreds of thousands or even the millions. I don't dispute that they could pull off such atrocities. I do doubt that they will achieve their goal of creating societies where Islamic law is applied and where a caliphate is created. I do think that there's another way that Islamists have that is more subtle, more political, less violent, and more sustainable. In part because it doesn't attract our attention and our venom in the way that, say, terrorism does. And that's working through the system. That is working with the media and the schools and the politicians and the law courts and the other institutions, the businesses, the institutions of society. And one can see this at play in the majority of Muslim countries and in the West. For example, in a country like Egypt, where there was a powerful terrorist organization that worked for many years called the Jamaa Islamiyah, which, for example, attacked tourists in Luxor, killing some 57, I think, Swiss and other tourists a few years ago, decimating the tourist trade in Egypt, which some 10% of Egyptians are said to rely on. They can have a real impact, but they were rejected. Had an approach that was unpopular. And so Jamaa Islamiyah gave up terrorism. And at first blush, it appeared to be a total victory. They'd given up. But in fact, they hadn't given up their goals. They gave up their tactics. They gave up violence, murder. And instead, they began to work through the system. And the Egyptian government has rewarded the Islamists who come in from the cold. It has given them television programs, access to the schools, an ability to organize the unions and syndicates, and as a result, to build hospitals and clinics, schools. And as a result, the Islamists are penetrating society and the state and are furthering their goals in a much more efficacious manner. One can see the same in Algeria, where there was a major insurrection in the 1990s. It was defeated. The Islamists are working through the system. In Syria, the insurrection, the violent insurrection, was capped in 1982 with an attack by the state on the city of Hama, killing an estimated 20,000 people. That insurrection's done, over with. But instead, one finds an infiltration of society. And likewise, in the West, one sees, yes, terrorism, but what are the benefits of terrorism? The only real example I can point to was Madrid, where the killing of a couple hundred people led to a change in policy towards Iraq. It didn't lead to an Islamization of Spain. And elsewhere, one looks, what did Bali achieve? What did 9/11 achieve? What did 7/7 achieve in London? What did Beslan achieve in Russia? What did these major atrocities achieve? I don't think one can point to much. But at the same time, one can see a chipping away, an eating, a termite-like eating through the institutions of society by the Islamists. And the most dramatic case is where Ida cut her teeth in the United Kingdom, where one sees the onrush of Islamization at extraordinary pace. Practically every day there's some news. And I'm someone who's been studying Islam for 4 decades now, and I'm astonished by the things that are taking place, the things that just haven't happened before. One can watch the transformation of Britain before one's very eyes. And this is happening not through violence. 7/7 was the exception. And it's, again, hard to see what it achieved. The real work is being done quietly, or not so quietly, evenly, but steadily through non-violent means, political means, lawful means. Let me give you one example. The Muslim Council of Britain, which is the most important Islamist institution in the country, has put out a couple of years ago a book about state-funded or taxpayer-funded schools, in which it gave its program for what changes it would like to see. And this 80-page booklet transforms British schools into Saudi schools, because it takes every aspect of school life, from the yearly schedule to the holidays to the weekly schedule and the prayer services, to the subjects being taught, such as art and history and religion, and food services, sports practices, relations between males and females. And if the whole of it were applied, it would be a fundamentally different school. Now, it has not been applied. But yet, the presence of this book and the backing of an important Islamist organization means that there's pressure steadily. And one finds, one day you wake up and you find that a primary school in Oxford is serving halal food just like that. And no one was really consulted. Or other such developments. And step by step, in the aggregate, one sees a change of society. Just as in Egypt or Algeria or Syria, one sees that same transformation taking place in the West. And I would argue that that's more effective. It's more effective because, on the one hand, it doesn't create the reaction. When a municipal swimming pool has women-only hours, is that banner headline? Two, there are not the institutions of state arrayed against it, as in the case of violence. When you have violence, you're provoking law enforcement, the military, the intelligence service, judiciary system, the entire gamut of the protective institutions of the state come into play. And they have lots of experience in crushing violent efforts. But when you have a movement that claims to have to be the carrier of a superior civilization, quietly going about its work, we, particularly in the West, have no muscle. We have no consciousness. This is not something we're aware of. So I think there has been a fundamental shift in the last decade or so, in that what appeared to be with Khomeini and bin Laden, what I call Islamism 1.0, you know, the first version of it, the first iteration, violent, and aggressive, totalitarian. Now one has Islamism 2.0, which is still aggressive, but in a political way, not a violent way, and I think has far greater prospects for success, be it in Algeria or in Britain, be it in in Egypt or in Australia. And I think one's focus needs to be much more on this insidious, quiet, political, lawful movement, and not just simply on the terrorism, the criminality, and the violence. Thank you.
Thanks to both our speakers for keeping their presentations to 15 minutes each. As I said, there are some copies of Daniel's books, earlier books, a few outside. There are copies of Ida's book outside. Daniel has to leave promptly, so if you're buying any of them you need, and you want to get them signed, you'll have to move quickly. Ida is not leaving so quickly, so she'll be here for supper, and we can sort it out then. So we come to questions and discussion. I think because of... there are a lot of people here, we've got to keep our comments brief. I think because there's such a height disparity, we'll use it this way. It's easier. Okay? I think you can hear this way. So, can I... Okay. All right. Okay, that's fine. Thanks. I'll just start off with just a comment to Daniel. I remember from the time you were last here, and I think you made the point tonight about Britain, and I think then you suggested, which was somewhat controversial, that Britain was less able to handle the problem of Islamism than France was, which I think caused some surprise among some people, but within a short time has proved to be true. So why do you think the response in France, where there's a very large Muslim population, is probably different to the response in Britain, where the population's a little bit smaller per head of population? If you just talk to the back of the room.
I think the key factor in how Western countries respond to this new challenge, the key factor is the sense of cultural confidence. And it's quite surprising how weak that sense is in Britain. There's guilt over imperialism and racism that is endemic to the thinking classes, chattering classes. Whereas in France, there's a much more robust sense of the value of being French. One trivial but nonetheless interesting example of that came about 6 years ago, when the advance team for President Khatami of Iran was negotiating with the French team on how the state visit by Khatami to France would work out. And the French said, "We'll be serving wine at dinner." And the Iranian says, "No, no wine, not with us." And the French say, "Well, you don't have to drink the wine. We serve the wine." And the Iranian said, "No." And it ended up being a reception instead of a dinner, because they couldn't reach terms on it. Now, that is trivial, but it also suggests that, I mean, you know, drinking wine is not exactly the most important aspect of French culture, but it meant the French are sticking by. The British don't do that.
Thank you, Daniel. So we come to Ellen.
A question for either Daniel or Ida. In Europe, over the last decade, we've seen popular revolutions effectively overthrow systems of government. In Iran recently, we had a revolution which was almost going to throw the current government out of business, and yet it didn't happen, and it still hasn't happened. And I'm wondering where either of you would predict Iran going, especially through its women, in the future, say over the next couple of years.
Let's start with Ida.
I think it's difficult to predict what's going to happen in Iran. There's a lot of energy there. It's absolutely amazing. And some of the reformers, like Zeba Mir Hosseini, has said that if it really gets going, it's going to be a flood, because the young people and the women are desperate for change. Now, one of the problems in the past has been the betrayal that they've felt. They've been betrayed by the Khomeini revolution. They thought that it would lead to a civil government with a civil society, but of course that didn't happen. It led to repression and a totalitarian system. And it happened again with Khatami. The women voted Khatami in, and one of their magazines, Zanan, featured him on the front cover, and they did everything they could to garner votes, and it happened. And they made a very big impact. And then they were sorely disappointed because he couldn't deliver. There were all sorts of excuses. Shirin Ebadi said he couldn't deliver because there were so many problems that he had within the system, rivalries, etc., etc. But in any case, it was a betrayal. And I don't think they're going to put up with that again. They will want a proper change. There's a lot of emotion out there. Young people want to be like the West. They actually like the United States there. They want Western dress. They want sexual freedoms. They want to be able to read Western books. So the emotion is there, but there'll still be lots of crackdowns once if this present government stays.
I first met Alan at an institute dinner some decade ago, and he gave me a copy of his book, his most recent book, and it took me 19 hours between here and Philadelphia to read the book, and I then reported to him my comments on it. I see the demonstrations of June not as an end point, but as a beginning point. As I mentioned earlier, I think the Islamic Republic of Iran is doomed, but I don't know the schedule. I do think there was a very major event. I do think that the Iranian, the Shiite religion with its notions of justice and the oppressed and martyrdom was a major factor in the revolution in Iran against the Shah in 1978-79 and is on call for use against the current regime. And I have no idea what the schedule will be, but I am quite confident to predict that this is one of a series of efforts against the regime. One was on the so-called Quds Day in September, another was on the anniversary yesterday of the 30 years of the takeover of the American embassy. These events and the martyrology that comes from them, I think, will provide the basis for the eventual overthrow of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I would argue to you that there's been a radicalization in June of momentous importance, that until then, the critics of the regime basically wanted to improve the regime. And now, since June, the critics want to get rid of the regime. And that is a major turning point.
Rachel Kahn?
I would say the passionate voices for feminism in the Muslim world. But in the Western world, I see the reverse. I see Muslim women being passionate about embracing the hijab or the niqab and kind of being more apologetic about their tradition. What do you see? And if I'm right, what hope have the passionate voices of women in the Middle East got for support in the West? How much support are they receiving?
So let's go with that. I had a question about the West, attitude of Muslim women in the West.
Thank you, Rachel. In the West, the Muslim women are in a time warp, in a way, in their communities. They can't leave the communities because they'll be ostracized. It's very difficult for them. In other countries like Iran, at least they have the support of their families. their mothers and their grandmothers, and to some extent the reformist press. But in the West, they're very isolated. They are also pressured in the West to wear the hijab and full Islamic dress by Islamists. And there have been a few cases in the UK as well on that subject. The problem is that they cannot leave their societies. As far as the Islamic dress goes, it's a sign of anti-Westernization, and it's also a fashion, something they don't want to easily give up. It's very hard for us to understand why they should want to do this, but nevertheless, it's part of their persona. There are some reformers who've talked about this. One of the male reformers from Tunisia, Lafif Lakhdar, for example, says that Muslim women have taken on the negative sides aspect of Islam, and it's become part of their person, and it's very difficult to change that. Now, as far as the Muslim women in the West go, what is striking is this question: why aren't they more assertive? I mean, after all, they are in a Western environment. There are no restrictions. They have freedom of speech, freedom of association and assembly. They really have all the means and the NGOs to make changes. But in fact, they don't. And not only that, the very educated ones who could have very strong opinions and could write, for example, in the universities, not only don't they support the reformers, but often they support the Islamists. You could ask, why is that? Maybe it's because when you're in a university, you conform to the ethos of that university. And if they want a promotion, then you have to go along with what the liberal left wants.
Yes, Daniel. Yeah, but then we go. Ben, did you have your hand up at the back?
I would suggest that it's easier to be passionate in opposition than in conformity. And if you're in Afghanistan, you're passionate against the burqa. But if you're in Australia, you're passionate against what you're all wearing now. That's where passion goes, is in opposition. I'd also like to suggest that one sees in the West evolution of women's actions and behavior that is astonishing. I'll cite you one example from about a week ago. In near New York, I think in New Jersey, a 40-something man, Muslim man, got married to a 37-year-old woman. He had some children already. So these are not young people. And he is not a practicing Muslim. And he urged his wife, his new wife, his third wife, I think, I mean, sequentially third, to ease up on Islam, drink alcohol, eat pork, wear more revealing clothes. She went along with it until her mother said, "What are you doing?" And then she got furious at her husband. Anyway, the point of this story is that while he was sleeping, she attacked him with a knife and tried to kill him. She did not succeed. But this is a sensation. Quite a story. I mention it because it's unheard of in traditional Muslim societies. No woman would attack them. It's just inconceivable. But yet it's taking place in the West. So we've seen all sorts of new phenomena, but I think it's due to the fact that they're in opposition. They're just being assertive of something which in Afghanistan doesn't need to be assertive. She doesn't need to do that there. There are other ways of limiting her husband. In New Jersey, there aren't.
Tony, why don't you sit down here? You sit there. I'll get out of the way here. Ben, did you have your hand up? Ben. Tom. Yeah. Oh, that one. Okay, let's go.
This is a question to Ida.
Ida,
about a year ago, the Muslim Women's Organization the stats on anxiety levels for Australian women was about 18.1%, which is 1 in 5. Drawing on your psychiatric background, could you indicate perhaps what you've sensed to be the anxiety level in the various regions that you've worked in amongst the women there?
And have you got time, the anxiety level in the room here might be helpful.
I think that, in my experience, they've been very loath to talk about it. And so it's been difficult. I think most of the Muslim colleagues that I've known have wanted to stick to the subject and not discuss anything related to the Muslim world. Very isolated in their attitudes. But I would suspect that they have a lot of problems. One group that I've been interested in particularly is the group of gay women. There's an organisation called SAFRA in the UK, and I mentioned it in my book. These women, I think, have a very high level of anxiety because they have a very big problem if they come out. There's no doubt that they need all the support that they can get, and the reports that have come in from there have been very serious because there's hardly any community support for gay people, and they're in serious trouble if they are found out, because the laws for homosexuality are the same as the laws for adultery.
Vera. Yeah, and then Dallas. Yeah, Vera.
I'm very much joining Rachel's question about how isolated or how widely accepted these women are. In other words, within their society, to other women, and even more so within our international scene, to the feminist movement. Because as everybody's pointing out, you yourself pointing out, sorry, the feminist movement is the exact opposite to what these women stand for. Are they reaching out? Do they attend conferences? Are they trying to reach out and actually influence the influenceable? The most influenceable are women, namely the international organizations and their own community of women.
Are you referring to the women in Muslim countries?
Yes.
Or the other way, the Muslim countries?
Yes.
Okay. There have been a few Iranian women who have gone out. They've got into a lot of trouble. They went to a Berlin conference, and when they came back, they had great problems with the government. So there are severe restrictions. There are other problems as well. There are Iranian groups who won't invite a lot of those women because they're worried about the sort of opinions that they might have and that they may be representing the Iranian government, for example. But as far as the other groups go, like the Afghani women, they travel a great deal. The women from Rawa, for example, they do travel, and they talk a lot about their difficulties, about their organisations, about what's happened to them. Rawa, of course, lost their founder in 1987 because she was killed by a combination of the Secret Service, the Soviet Secret Service, and the Islamists in Afghanistan.
So Dallas on the back, yeah?
And my question is for Daniel. And if I could get Daniel's thoughts on the address President Obama made in Cairo soon after his inauguration, and also